listening to the RotoViz Best Ball Podcast Series, a RotoViz podcast series that covers all things related to best ball leagues. I'm your host, Blair Andrews. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Mike Beers. Mike is a writer at RotoViz and RotoGrinders, and he recently won the 2017 FFPC Pros vs. Joes contest. Mike, thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm happy to be here on the show. Excited to talk about some best ball.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's get right into it. The first thing I want to ask you about is actually the Pros versus Joes contest. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just a regular FFPC Draft Experts format, with the notable exception that you're playing against some of the other, you know, some of the best best ball players around. So I guess walk me through how you prepare for a contest like that.
Yeah, so one thing about it, I mean, the big thing that you mentioned is the competition, right? So it's other analysts, sort of big names that a lot of people would recognize in my same draft, along with high stakes players, you know, people who are putting real money into these drafts every year. And it changes things a little bit. I mean, you know, I was drafting a couple spots away from Evan Silva, and Rich Rebar was in my draft as well. And, you know, when I'm drafting with guys like this, I'm not expecting to, you know, find some great sleepers, you know, that they haven't thought of. I mean, these guys, they know the players better than I do. So what I wanted to do was stick to what I know best, which is, you know, how to play best ball specifically, you know, where the value is in the draft. By the time I did the Pros versus Joes draft, I'd probably done, you know, 20 or 30 best ball drafts over on MFL. So I had a pretty good idea of ADP and where people thought players should be going. And, you know, my team ended up being a fairly boring team for that reason. I wasn't reaching for any guys in particular. I was waiting for, you know, the value to fall to me. And it ended up working out. I mean, there's a lot of luck involved in winning that kind of league, especially given the competition and the fact that there are actually six leagues of people. And so I had to beat out 71 other people to be the champion. But my team stayed relatively healthy, and it worked out.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. You mentioned that you don't, you know, these guys like Evan Silva and Rich Rebar know the players better than you. Does that make you, I guess, focus more on roster construction, lineup construction in that sort of league, or?
Yeah, it's both roster construction and just keeping in mind you know, value I'm getting relative to ADP. For example, you know, one of the best picks I made in the draft was Todd Gurley in the third round, right? And, you know, he had a very high win rate across leagues in MFLs. We'll talk about that later. But, you know, I wasn't particularly high on Gurley myself. You know, I didn't go into the season with a huge amount of exposure to him. I wasn't reaching for him in any drafts. But by the time it was early in the third round, I had a workhorse running back was still on the board because the other guys were reaching for tight ends, or you know, he was just out of favor. I was just looking to lock in the touches at a good price, and he was just sitting there for me, so I took him. It was kind of one of those picks where it's like I don't even know if I really want him, but I kind of have to because the value is too good. And that was my approach to most of the draft. Just looking for volume and, you know, at a good price.
Well, I suspect some of our listeners are people who maybe they haven't played much best ball. They are coming from a redraft, you know, regular redraft within season management leagues, and are ready to kind of dip their toes in or get more serious about it. So I guess what would you say is the biggest difference in how you approach best ball drafts compared to a draft with in-season management?
So the biggest difference is the lack of waiver wire, and the fact that you aren't setting your lineups each week. It makes it a very different game from season long. You know, you're drafting a very deep team. You have to be able to withstand injuries. You know, you can't just have one quarterback, for example, which you can easily do in a season long league. There are always players available on the wire. But the big thing for me is not having to pick the player you start each week really increases the value of what most people call like boom bust players, particularly wide receivers. So later in the draft, I focus on wide receivers. Early on, I try to get running backs who, you know, who are going to have a lot of touches, a lot of volume, but I want those sort of deep shot, you know, they may have several 0 to 5 point games in the year, but if they have, you know, two or three or four 20 point games, I know they're going to make it into my starting lineup, and I don't have to worry about figuring out which week they're going to go off. As long as I'm confident it's going to happen a few times, they're going to get into my starting lineup. They're going to contribute to my team, and I don't care what they do the rest of the time. And if you have a lot of those guys, you know, they piece together a very strong season for you in your starting lineup.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, zero running back is really popular at RotoViz, of course, but it sounds like you tend to go into best ball drafts with almost an opposite mindset. Is that accurate or?
Not always, but it tends to work out that way because you have more of those boom bust players at the wide receiver position than at running back. So it's just harder to find them later in the draft. But you know, I don't stick to one strategy when I'm going into these drafts, like a zero running back or zero wide receiver or something like that. I really take it as the draft comes to me, and I'm doing so many of these drafts over the summer that I might end up with a zero RB build halfway through a draft. And, you know, I'll just, because that's where the value fell to me, and I'll adapt, and I'll have to, you know, make the rest of the picks accordingly, make sure I have a balanced roster and I'm following sort of my roster construction principles once the first six or seven rounds have established how I'm going to start.
All right. Before moving on, I want to remind all our listeners that you can get a subscription to a RotoViz NFL Pass right now for 30% off. It's available through the NFL podcast homepage, rotoviz.com/podcast. Your subscription gives you unlimited access to all of our content and tools, and it also supports the pod. So, Mike, you have an article that will soon be up on RotoViz about player win rates. Could you briefly explain, I guess, what you mean by player win rates and what you found about 2017?
Yeah, so win rates, I really like this statistic because it combines both the performance of a player and where they were drafted, you know, by ADP. It really highlights who were the best picks as opposed to who were the best players. And a win rate is the percent of teams that a player was drafted on that actually won their leagues. So, you know, if Gurley was drafted 4,000 times and, you know, 1,000 of those teams won, he would have a 25% win rate. And why it's so good is, you know, a good player found later in the draft is going to be on more winning teams. And it really highlights the value of that pick. You were able to uncover a lot of value there. And so I look at this every year. And one thing I really concentrate on is not really, you know, the names associated with the win rates, but more the areas of the draft and the positions and how the win rates are distributed each year. You know, looking at this year's data, you know, a couple of things stood out, particularly at the beginning of the draft, you know, the first four rounds or so. You had a couple of the highest win rates of any player, Todd Gurley and Le'Veon Bell, but you also had a lot of busts, you know, guys with less than 5% win rate when in a 12-team league, average is 8.3%. And that what that tells me is, and this is true most years, you have more busts than really big hits in the early rounds. And so I'm not going to try to concentrate too much of my sort of best ball portfolio in players from those rounds, because I know that the downside from being wrong about one of those players, is worse, than the upside from being right. And it's really hard to be right. You know, another thing I found looking at these win rates, and again, year after year, is looking at defenses. The defenses with the highest win rates pretty much every year are the ones taken later in the draft. You know, for the fourth year in a row now, the top three defenses off the board by ADP all had below average win rates. They were all pretty bad. And you know, this tells me in the single year is I'm going to be one of the first players taking a defense in the draft. I'm going to wait until the last three rounds. you know, it's very hard to predict how defenses are going to turn out by the end of the year anyway. So I'm not real picky about which ones I get. I'm going to take three. I'm going to take them late, and I'm pretty confident I'm going to get enough points out of them. So that's one major takeaway from this stuff. And then another thing I look at is the distribution of win rates within positions. So if you were looking at wide receivers or running backs, you've got guys who have win rates as low as 2%, particularly guys who got injured. And then you have players who are up you know, close to 20% or 30% in the case of Gurley. And that's a really wide range. But at tight end, you only have, you know, it only got up as high as 14%. And most of the players were closer to average. There weren't any big losers, or there weren't many big losers. And what that tells me is I'm not really going to try to make any big bets on tight ends, because even if I'm right, it's not a huge payoff for me. You know, I'm not going to put all of my eggs in one basket, because I could get it wrong. A player could get injured, and that would be disastrous. And if I get it right, the tight end is probably not going to change my entire year. There just aren't that many great picks. So it's stuff like that, sort of pockets of the draft, you know, where the most value can be found. That's what this win rate stuff really tells me.
So have you found, I guess, sort of consistently over the years, there are certain spots in the draft where you're always going to be trying to take a certain position, like you always take wide receivers in the middle of the draft or something like that?
You know, it's not always the same every year, but one in particular is, well, there's certainly the defenses. As I mentioned, I'm saving them for the end. The data pretty strongly points to that being the best way to go. And then the other area I've found is quarterback. Sort of in the, by ADP, the quarterback 10 to quarterback 16 or 17 range, that area has had a lot more high win rate plays than low win rate over the past 5 years. And it, so I went into this year sort of knowing that, having looked at the data, and then it happened again this year. I mean, sort of the best pocket of the draft was the 10 to 15 range, where you found guys like Kirk Cousins, Roethlisberger, Dak Prescott, Matthew Stafford. They all had above average win rates. And that's an area that I was focusing in the draft. I would usually wait until the 9th or 10th round where those guys were going before I would take my first quarterback.
All right. So what would you say was your worst call, your biggest miss in 2017?
Well, I don't think those two are the same thing for me. So I'll start with my biggest miss, which was I had a lot of Spencer Ware exposure before he went down in the preseason. And the reason I say that's my biggest miss but not my worst call is, you know, I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't gotten injured. We all know how well Kareem Hunt did. And it, you know, maybe Ware would have done just as well. Maybe not. Maybe Hunt would have taken his job anyway. But it certainly didn't work out for my best ball teams. Regardless, I don't feel like I got that one wrong. A few that I did get wrong though were I really liked Emmanuel Sanders this year. Then the quarterback situation in Denver ended up being a mess, and he really did not produce. I also bet on a bounce back for Kelvin Benjamin, and between, you know, some injury and then the trade to Buffalo, it really did not work out for him either. I thought he would be a real touchdown threat a lot of the year, and it certainly didn't help my teams. And those were guys who I thought were just very underpriced. You know, their pass production wasn't being appreciated in drafts. And, you know, I got those wrong. And it certainly did not help my ROI at the end of the year.
All right. Well, I'll give you a chance to redeem yourself a little bit later. But first I want to ask, sort of from a strategic perspective, are there areas that you think the best ball community at large tends to overemphasize?
Yeah, I think... you know, I mentioned earlier the idea that boom bust players are very important. I think it does get a little overemphasized though, especially when people are thinking about their picks early in the draft. You know, I actually am not concentrating on that kind of player in the first, you know, 7 or 8 rounds of the draft. I'm looking for guys who are just going to get a lot of touches. They usually have a higher price tag, and I want to lock them in. because, you know, more touches just means more chances to score touchdowns, more chances for big plays. Even if they're not known for big plays, they're going to happen if they're constantly touching the ball. And then, you know, I think saving those picks for the last, you know, bottom half of the draft is really the way to go. Looking for big play guys, like, you know, popular picks in the past have been like Torrey Smith or, you know, Ted Ginn this year. Those deep threat kind of guys that'll make those splash plays. I do think they're very important, but, you know, you don't need to reach for them early in the draft or look for someone who has a very low floor early in the draft just because of the best ball format. Another thing I think is important and is might get a little too much attention is the idea that you have to shoot for a lot of upside, you know, everywhere. People reach a lot for running backs in the bottom half of the draft, really the bottom quarter of the draft, say around 16 to 20, thinking they need to find, you know, this year's Kareem Hunt or and it certainly helps to have those guys, but they are few and far between, especially when you get into the teens. And a lot of times they end up being wasted picks. I mean, the number of times you actually hit on a pick like that versus the reward for getting the guy is really not a good trade-off, I found, looking at the data. And so I'm focusing on wide receivers and defenses and tight ends down there, guys who are less likely to, you know, give me nothing by the end of the year. So I think you need to shoot for upside, but you need to be smart about where you do it.
All right. And then kind of the flip side of that question, are there things that you think people should be emphasizing more?
I think it's just being smart about roster construction. You know, there's not one right way to build your best ball team, but there are a lot of wrong ways. And, you know, being flexible about how you build your team is very important. You know, you may think you're going to go into a draft, you want to take wide receivers early, and you're only going to draft seven of them, and you're going to have five running backs, and you've sort of figured it out. And then, you know, the draft actually plays out differently. You land two great values at running back early, and you want to change the way you're going to, well, you should change the way you're going to approach the draft. And that's really how I look at it. You know, I'm taking the best player available for the first five or six rounds without thinking about roster construction at all, really. But after that, it becomes very important to me. I think about who's already on my roster. Okay, how strong is this position relative to the others? You know, if I have no tight ends through nine rounds, well, I'm probably going to need three of them. But if I have two, then I shouldn't be taking any more of them. And I'm willing to move between that two and three at tight end, the two and three at quarterback, you know, between five and eight at wide receiver, or really six and nine at wide receiver. You know, just being flexible and being able to move between that and paying attention to it. I think people can let it get away from them and realize they have, you know, they've been picking wide receivers for, you know, six straight rounds, and then they see two great values later that they really like at the position. They wind up with eight, and they're very, very, very thin at running back. You don't want to get caught in that trap. You just got to keep your head up.
Yeah, that's good stuff. You mentioned kind of, you know, seeing what players you took early in the draft will change kind of what players you decide to take later in the draft. I guess one thing that people often ask about best ball, where that might come into play, is the idea of stacking. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, about whether that's a smart strategy in best ball leagues, or do you try to do it, or not even, do you not even care about it?
Yeah, so it's not really something I pay attention to. You know, I ended up on my Pros vs. Joes team, I had, I think, five Saints, and that ended up working out because offense pretty good this year, but it wasn't intentional. It was really just how the value fell, and I don't think there's a lot of value to stacking in these leagues. You know, people seem to sort of equate it to a DFS GPP because you're shooting first place, but the reality is, you know, this isn't a 1 week game. Best ball, you're playing over the whole season, and the correlation between your players week to week isn't really that important. You know, the fact that a quarterback and wide receiver might have a a great week at the same time isn't necessarily a great thing for your best ball team. You're really looking to accumulate those points over the course of the whole year. And, you know, so if you really believe in an offense, go get multiple players from that offense. But from a correlation or just mathematical perspective, I don't think the value is really there. So I wouldn't reach for those kind of players.
We've been talking a lot about the sort of different formats you play in, MFL 10s and FFPC. I actually live in a state where MFL 10s weren't operating last year, so I had to do most of my best ball on the draft app. So I wonder, these are all different scoring systems. Some are half PPR, some have tight end premium. How do you approach these different formats differently, if at all?
So I don't change my approach very much, though you certainly have to be aware of the scoring. You know, on draft versus MFL, for example, you mentioned draft had half PPR scoring. I definitely pushed up running backs in terms of priority for my drafting, you know, given that they just score more points relative to wide receivers or relative to the other league, full PPR versus wide receivers. It just makes sense to prioritize them. There are fewer sort of those favorite zero RB late running backs who are going to contribute when you aren't collecting as many points for their receptions. So, you know, in that sense, I did change my strategy a little bit. And then, you know, in FFPC, where they have that tight end premium scoring, the Pros vs. Joes competition was FFPC, used that format. And I waited on tight end because I saw everyone else, I think, bit a little too hard on the tight end premium scoring. They were reaching for tight ends. You know, I ended up drafting four guys who really were not very good, to be honest, but they were good enough to fill the position, and I was able to, you know, build strength at other spots that I felt were more important. So I think it's really, it's a balance of understanding, you know, the extra value at the position from the scoring and understanding how everybody else is reacting to that. And, you know, sort of picking your spots there. The other difference on FFPC is you have those much bigger rosters and you have the kicker position. So I'm more willing to do something like take, you know, I might take four defenses in a league with a 28 round draft as opposed to only 20 on MFL, something like that, or four kickers, really bolster a position that I'm not as confident in my ability to predict. You know, I want to be deeper there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's really interesting. You mentioned how a lot of people see the tight end premium scoring and they think they have to get one of the elite tight ends. But you, kind of like you mentioned, in my experience, what that does is increase the value of the late round tight ends even more. So you don't necessarily have to approach it the way you might initially think.
Right. And I think the big advantage is really for maybe the top three tight ends, the ones who are getting, you know, a lot of volume relative to everybody else, because there tends to be kind of a tier break there. But then the next sort of level of them, you really don't need to push them up as much in your rankings. And I think people do in spite of that.
One thing I want to ask you about that I know people ask about often is how much you worry about your exposure to specific players. You know, do you want to try to have pretty precise exposure, or is that something you don't pay as much attention to?
So I do pay attention to it because I play a lot of leagues. You know, I think if you're only doing, you know, 5 or 10 best ball leagues throughout the year, then you really can just ignore it entirely. Just take each draft, you know, as it falls, and don't worry about your exposure. But if you're playing more like 50 to 100 or even more, like some people do, it is worth paying attention to. I already mentioned the risk involved in concentrating in guys early in the draft. You know, those first few rounds, you know, David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell this year, you know, they were the 1 and 2 picks. And, you know, some people picked Bell over Johnson, you know, but it was really a lot of people saw it as a coin flip. And if you were really concentrated in Bell, you did great this year, you know, almost certainly, unless you really screwed up the rest of your drafts. But if you were really concentrated in David Johnson, you really got screwed. And, you know, right next to him, you found Odell Beckham, who had a terrible win rate, right, because of his injury. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's not worth the risk there. I mean, I think you really, really, really have to be confident in that pick. And almost nobody is good enough to justify being that confident in those early round picks. There are busts every year that we don't see coming for reasons that we couldn't possibly see coming. It's just not worthwhile. I would hope to limit, I wouldn't want more than 20% exposure to one of those guys early on, if I really like them. But later in the draft, I don't mind taking shots on players if I really like them. For example, I was very high on Ted Ginn this year, and I was happy to draft him, basically anytime he fell near his ADP. And if that meant, I had close to 30 or 35% exposure to him, it wasn't as big a deal to me because his ADP was much lower. It was in, maybe 10th, 11th round. If I was wrong about him, being wrong about a pick that late in the draft is not going to sink your team like being wrong on David Johnson would be. So it's just a better risk reward kind of thing. And that's where I think, if you're confident in your ability to identify these players, that's the better place to take your shot.
Is there like a maximum exposure, sort of an upper limit you would have for a player even in a later round? Like you mentioned, 35% dead gain. Is that about your upper limit for a late round guy?
Yeah, I think so. But I didn't really arrive at that scientifically. It was really that's kind of how it's played out the past few years. And when I've gotten to that point, I started to feel a little bit uncomfortable. With the number of drafts, it's hard to get one player, more often than that, unless you're really reaching versus ADP. And that's something I really don't like to do. I pay close attention to ADP. I really want to get guys later than they're typically being drafted. Because I know I'm going to do another draft next time and he might be more expensive. And sort of across all my leagues, I'll have, a better value or a better average cost if I approach it that way. So I'm not going to reach for one guy in every single league to end up, with greater than 50% exposure or something like that.
Are you at all worried about being over-diversified and not kind of maintaining a tight core of players?
I don't really worry about that. I think you can. There are multiple ways to win. Even Todd Gurley this year had a 31% win rate in MFL 10 leagues. Yeah, but that means he had a 69% loss rate, right? You didn't have to have Todd Gurley in order to win your league. You didn't have to have Le'Veon Bell. You didn't have to have any of the guys or Alvin Kamara. So I don't think you have to really put your eggs on any one or two or three baskets. If you draft smart, you draft value, you build, roster construction that makes sense, you can win without placing those big bets. So I don't really worry about it.
All right. I promised you I'd give you a chance to redeem yourself. So what was your best call or your biggest hit in 2017?
So I guess a couple of them who were drafted around the same area of the draft were Adam Thielen and Ted Ginn were two guys who I really bought into. Thielen, particularly early in the offseason, I thought he wasn't getting nearly enough respect. You were getting him in the double-digit rounds. He had just had a great year, very efficient receiver, and even pricing in some regression from his great year with, Diggs coming back healthy and everything. He was way underpriced, or at least that's how I felt. He picked up a little bit of steam over the offseason, so I wasn't drafting him as much, in August. But that one, and I, big plays, catching passes from Drew Brees, it seemed like just an ideal environment change for him. And it took a very long time for his price to catch up with the potential there. And again, he had sort of an up and down year, but that's what you expect from him. And he was priced appropriately for that. And he ended up helping a lot of best ball teams.
All right. I got kind of an imaginative question here. Suppose you could go back in time to before you started playing best ball. What's the best advice you'd give yourself not related to player evaluation?
I think it would be don't draft a defense before the 17th round would be one piece of advice that I'm very, very confident in. I think I probably, the first year I played, I made that mistake a few times. And then also, you know, the idea I mentioned earlier, just, you know, letting the draft sort of develop, finding value early, and then paying attention to how your roster fits together in the second half of the draft, you know, and being patient. You know, you're going to have players you like every year, and you don't have to reach for them if you're going to do more than, you know, two or three drafts. You know, reach for them in your season-long leagues or your home league where you know you're not going to have another chance to get them. But if you're doing a bunch of best ball leagues, just be patient. You know, if somebody reached for a player you really wanted, you'll get them next time at a better price. And I think that's really important to remember.
Yeah, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about an article you wrote a couple years ago, really interesting strategy piece about a hyper-fragile draft strategy, where the idea was you take three sort of elite running backs with your first three picks, and then, you know, that was it for your lineup construction. I guess in 2016, the ADP kind of made this really possible and made it successful. I wonder if this is something, is this a strategy you look to use in other seasons, or is it just the particulars of how the ADP was that year that made it work?
Yeah, so I think it ended up working in 2016. But I wouldn't, and I did try it a couple times in 2017, but it really was about the ADP, you know, the way things, running backs were, the prices were just so depressed in that 2016 season that you could get pretty confidently, you could just go into the draft and think, I can get three top 15 running backs, and then I can go from there. This year, going into this season, things had really corrected quite a bit. Wide receivers didn't have as strong a year in 2016. They weren't, you know, the first four picks off the board anymore. And it was just harder to get three of those top 15 running backs this year. So, you know, when I had a chance to, typically it was when I had an early pick. So something like Le'Veon Bell and then two running backs at the second and third round turn. I might try it then. But it was really sort of a unique opportunity in 2016. You know, and I only came up with the idea because I noticed the trend that running backs were just so much cheaper than they had ever been in the past. And, you know, that was how I decided I would take advantage of it. But if you don't have that sort of mispricing or that opportunity, it's not something that you should try to force into your roster, because that really sort of defeats the purpose. You were really trying to take advantage of the mispriced production by trying that strategy.
Yeah. I know, you know, Draft has already started their best ball leagues for the 2018 season. And I've been in a couple where maybe there have been only two wide receivers taken in the first round, you know, really extreme the other way. Sort of seems like an overcorrection. I wonder if, is there an opportunity to do something sort of the reverse of this, this strategy, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, if it continues that way, there's definitely, you know, we have to consider the context of the league, and, you know, it's 2 years in a row now that wide receiver scoring has been down at the top of the draft, but, that doesn't necessarily mean that we should abandon the wide receivers. I think you're having, if that, you know, if drafts like you just described continue to happen, I'm almost certainly will be moving to more wide receivers early. I mean, that's what I mentioned earlier about not going into drafts with like a zero RB or zero wide receiver strategy in mind. Really going to adapt to what everyone else in my draft is doing. And if that's what's happening, absolutely, I think the winning move is going to be, you know, sort of zagging from that. And not falling into the idea that, you know, everyone else is taking them, so you better get yours while you can. They're just like with the tight ends in FFPC, if people are overvaluing one position, you can really make off well by attacking the value they leave on the table.
Just want to follow up on the hyper-fragile strategy. I wonder, even if the ADP doesn't necessarily fit the strategy, are there sort of theoretical elements of it that you maybe look to employ no matter the lineup construction you're going for?
Well, it's really the idea of sort of balance between the positions. So, you know, the hyper-fragile strategy, you were only drafting three running backs because you were using so much draft capital on them. And they should be able to generate enough production for you to win. And that idea always applies. So, you know, if I were to use an early pick on, like, Rob Gronkowski, for example, I've already invested enough draft capital at tight end that I know there's no point in taking three of them. I'm going to end up with sort of an off-balance roster. And so you apply that logic to wherever this year's value is falling, and you might end up with your hyper-fragile wide receiver strategy this year. It would maybe only drafting five of them or something. It could play out that way using the exact same thought process.
What would you say to the person who's in a position, I suspect maybe a lot of people are, where they have played best ball maybe a year or two, but are not yet very successful at it, not yet profitable? What's the best way, you think, for them to improve?
I think one way is to sort of read up on the stuff that's written out there by not just myself, but a lot of other people about roster construction, just because it's an easy way to shoot yourself in the foot, with a roster construction that doesn't make sense, something like taking four quarterbacks in an MFL 10 or, only drafting five wide receivers late in the draft. You can easily improve your game if you were making mistakes like that. And then also, try to figure out why you didn't win last year. So what I like to do is I look at who were my most drafted players, look at the top of the list, the ones that were misses. Is there any pattern there? Are there any guys I, was clearly favoring that I shouldn't have? And, or the big winners who I missed out on, why did I miss out on them? And really, I mean, you're not going to get a lot of calls or an excessive amount of calls wrong every single year. So, just come back with a mindset that you're going to look for value. You don't have to make big bets. And as long as you're drafting in a, in a patient, thoughtful way, you can come back and win pretty easily without having to do anything drastic.
Yeah, we kind of mentioned, 2018 best ball leagues are already starting up, getting ready to get going. I wonder, how are you planning to approach 2018 at this sort of early stage?
Yeah, well, my approach every year is I like to get into some drafts early on just to see how other people are drafting. You get a feel for ADP, and then I kind of sit back and try to figure out, what's going on this year. Like 2 years ago, it was that running backs were very cheap. Last year, I noticed they had bounced back, and think about how that should affect my strategy. Figure out, if I have an early pick or a late pick, how the drafts are playing out, and, what makes the most sense to attack early versus late. And really, I'm sort of in a... I'm an observer at this point, and then I'm going to develop a strategy probably within the next couple of months that may be 2 months after, depending on what happens in the market or ADP. But it's really about being flexible and seeing how the cards are dealt in front of me.
All right, cool. Anything else coming up for you in the future? Any articles we should look out for? What are you up to?
Yeah, so, well, you mentioned that I've got an article on player win rates coming out on RotoViz pretty soon here. It'll be, within the next day or so. And then from there, I'll do another or sort of an update of last year's article on roster construction, looking at win rates there, seeing if there are any patterns that we can learn from. And, at that point, usually I'll go into, I'll look into something like a strategy or a bigger project after I've sort of taken care of that initial data and analysis. This is around the time last year I did a big project on optimization of roster construction optimization, and ended up being a multi-part article. And you know, that's the kind of thing that maybe to look out for sometime soon, but maybe a couple months out. Hopefully in the meantime, I'll be, you know, I'm active on Twitter. I post a lot of charts on player performance and stuff like that. So that's certainly stuff to look out for.
All right, cool. Be sure to look out for all that stuff. That's going to do it for today's edition of the RotoViz Best Ball Series. I'm Blair Andrews. You can find me on Twitter at @AmITheRealBlair. Special thanks to our guest, Mike Beers, who you can find at BeersWater. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you for listening to the RotoViz Best Ball Series. Please rate and review the RotoViz Radio podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Contact us by email, rotovizradio@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, @RotoVizRadio. And remember, you can always support the pod by subscribing to RotoViz at a 30% discount through the RotoViz Radio homepage, rotoviz.com/podcast.